Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, where Michelle Rowland makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here last in 2013, following her great achievement in holding that seat in the swing against Labor, and we had her here with Sarah Henderson, who won a seat that year, for a very interesting discussion. Now, she's well known to you, but I'll introduce her briefly. Studied arts and law at Sydney University with an LLM in law. This qualified her to become a checkout staffer, but also to work in business and as a lawyer. But most importantly, a Member of Parliament since 2010, and even more importantly, the Shadow Minister for Communications, on which topic Ms. Rowland's going to speak to us tonight. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Good evening, everyone. I start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we gather, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. And thank you to Gerard Henderson and the Sydney Institute for hosting me today and for the contribution this forum makes to public policy discourse in Australia. Tonight I'd like to set out some thinking I've been developing over the past few years in the communications portfolio space and apply them to some contemporary issues. And when I look back at some of the initiatives, conferences, technological predictions and inquiries in the sector over those years, there is often reference to Australia and the world in or beyond the year 2020, now barely 9 months away. So let's get to it. I've chosen the title of The Road Ahead for this address because it speaks to three matters that are constantly front of my mind in both the communications portfolio and my political life generally. To explain the first, I take you back to a Year 11 student at an all-girls Catholic school in 1988. There was no social media, no email. The internet didn't even exist in my well-worn dictionary. I had never seen a mobile phone. Yet I was socially and politically aware, as were my friends at school, as were many of my colleagues at the supermarket where I worked in Blacktown, with frequent debate over current affairs in the lunchroom. When I'm asked about how and why I got into politics, mainly by school children, I recall that I had both stimulating teachers at Our Lady of Mercy Parramatta and that I was lucky to have a dad who worked as circulation manager at John Fairfax and Sons. Every night he would bring home a bag of newspapers and magazines from around Australia and even the world. I read Ross Gittins for my economics homework. So when the occasion presented itself to protest against the education cuts inflicted by the New South Wales Greiner government and its Education Minister Terry Metherill, I was there with my friends and tens of thousands of other citizens. The notion of cutting funding for education and sacking teachers was repugnant to me. It was short-sighted, mean, just unfair. 30 years later, Australian students are out protesting again. This time, it's about government inaction on climate change. To vent their anger with a government who's now Prime Minister brandished a lump of coal in Parliament as an immature stunt with his pet rock. To demand genuine, lasting action that transcends party politics and vested interests. These students can't vote, not yet anyway. But to anyone who thinks that today's young people are disengaged, isolated, passive or mindless consumers, scrolling through endless hours of selfies, you should think again. Young people are engaging in Australian democracy and having their say about our nation's future. A shrewd political meme created by a 14-year-old at the dinner table on their smartphone can attract thousands of comments and shares in a few hours, receiving vastly more traction than most political press conferences. According to McCrindle Insights, Generation Z, born from 1995 to 2009, was shaped in the era that society started looking at screens more than faces. Gen Z is defined by five factors. They are digital. They are the first truly global generation. They are social in nature. They are mobile and they are visual. Also known as the net generation or screen ages, These digital natives will comprise almost one-third of the entire workforce within a decade. Young people are forward-looking. They're not afraid of technology. They're not concerned with protecting vested interests or traditional business models, whether in the face of climate change or disruptive digitisation. Indeed, they understand too well the need to adapt as action on climate change and the fourth industrial revolution powered by 5G, artificial intelligence and data will fundamentally reshape our economy and society, including the work they will themselves perform. Young people expect their government to secure the nation's prosperity into the future. They deserve a government that acts today with an eye to tomorrow, be it delivering quality education, addressing climate change, or delivering decent broadband. So young people have every reason to protest when a government they cannot vote against, lacking an agenda and consumed with infighting, turns to fear as a cause for power. In the face of the breakdown of trust in institutions, with everyone from the banks, the church, the aged care and disability sector having failed the vulnerable in our community, and with concerns about global instability associated with climate change, the fourth industrial revolution and geopolitical realignment to grapple with, what does this federal government do? It seeks to make people more fearful and less trusting. Sick asylum seekers will take your hospital beds, they say. An emissions reduction target will spur the end of nighttime footy and cricket, they say. Apparently, it will also mean a $9,000 hit to your wages. That's the energy minister today. This brand of politics has a unique odour. It's reactive. It's about immediate risk mitigation. And it's incapable of a future focus. And it's in that context the first of my imperatives arise when considering the road ahead for communications policy in Australia. That is long-termism. From envisioning the national broadband network to the kind of society we want to be in the Internet of Things, to seriously utilising technology to address digital exclusion amongst Indigenous Australians, older Australians and Australians with a disability, the only way governments can make technology work for its citizens rather than against them is with a long-term approach. And make no mistake, as I move around my electorate and indeed many parts of Australia, the absence of long-termism is the issue that frustrates people the most. From overdevelopment in our outer suburbs, train stations made inaccessible by inadequate commuter parking, to purchasing 27,000 kilometres of new copper to build a supposedly 21st century broadband network, people are frustrated because it's their quality of life that is impacted by such short-sightedness. And that brings me back to the road ahead and the second of my imperatives, the need for a comprehensive strategy to drive the digital economy. Now, we all remember upon Malcolm Turnbull's elevation to the Prime Ministership, his language was future-looking and it underlined the contrast to his predecessor. We heard a lot about being dynamic, agile, innovative, excited. There were predictions his tenure would rival that of Menzies. The release of his billion-dollar innovation agenda some 3 months later, calling for an ideas boom, appeared to back up the rhetoric. He identified the need for economic transition. His language explored the future of work. There were over 20 measures ranging from STEM to tax incentives. Put aside the fact that some 6 months later, after very nearly losing the election, Turnbull was being white-anted and that very policy was being used as ammunition. Because less than 2 years after that, the Auditor General delivered a scathing assessment of the Turnbull flagship strategy, the one that was meant to define his long and glorious reign. As Stephanie Peatling beautifully surmised, its report could have been a script for utopia. It criticised the foundations of the policy, the quality of the advice that underpinned it, and concluded that some high-dollar economic proposals relied on assertion rather than evidence. I draw on this example for two reasons. Firstly, I have long called for recognition by this government that the communications sector is in transition and a comprehensive roadmap is needed to help guide the way forward for the highly valuable and strategic networks and industry within the portfolio. Digitisation, convergence and technological innovation have ushered in new ways of delivering and receiving services and content, yet our laws barely recognise these changes. What once were distinct broadcasters, telco and print media companies are now multi-platform operators, generating video content, podcasts, news and interactive experiences. Over-the-top companies, including global digital platforms like Google and Facebook, streaming services like Netflix, as well as VoIP services like Skype, have all emerged. New industries and revenue streams have grown. Some old ones are struggling, while others have evolved. We now count app developers and YouTubers as part of the creative industries ecosystem. The marketing industry has evolved the capacity to deliver innovative tech-based solutions to address client needs. We're still identifying ways to utilise 4G as early business cases for 5G technology begin to take shape. Yet Australia's policy and regulatory framework for media and communications remains stuck in the siloed analogue era of last century, and as a result, we're missing out as a nation. If Australia is to realise the benefits of digitisation, convergence and innovation, a genuine and holistic program of reform is needed to modernise the policy and regulatory framework governing the sector. Without such reform, consumers remain exposed to a inconsistent patchwork of content standards determined by what platform they are on. Traditional media and telco companies suffer the anti-competitive effects of regulatory disparity. The creative industries, including the screen production and interactive game development sectors, miss out on a range of growth and investment opportunities. Network investment, upgrade and deployment lags, and Australia fails to grow the jobs and industries of the future, fails to harness trade opportunities, and fails to facilitate content creation that enriches our cultural expression, enhances social cohesion and builds the nation. Now, other jurisdictions around the world do have joined up cross-portfolio visions and strategies for communications and have updated their regulatory frameworks many times over. It is unacceptable that this work remains unplanned and undone in Australia. The case for genuine reform of the policy and regulatory framework was made out many years ago. The former Labor government commissioned the Convergence Review, which recommended far-reaching reforms along with staged implementation. And since then, successive chairs of the ACMA have referred to the framework as strained, broken, and irrelevant. In contrast, this government has articulated next to nothing in terms of the vision for communications, 5G, or the digital economy. There is no communications strategy to speak of, and only a paltry 5G directions paper that mentions usual business of government processes and which fails to set out the true reform task that lies ahead for 5G in Australia. The government squibbed its much-anticipated digital economy strategy, releasing Australia's Tech Future only days before Christmas last year, a document vague on targets and outcomes, which merely describes initiatives already in train and offers no bold vision to drive growth in our digital economy. For well over 2 years now, and ever since the then Secretary of the Department of Communications and the Arts mentioned they were working on it, I have expected and wanted to see this government's communications policy roadmap. I've wanted it to make sense of the government's legislative agenda, to understand the impact of various delays to that agenda, and to inform Labor's policy responses. And I'm acutely aware that a variety of stakeholders desire it for many commercial reasons to formulate their own strategies. For example, with a roadmap, there is more readily a shared understanding of the timing of a future upgrade of the terrestrial broadcast platform, for which other jurisdictions around the world are well progressed, as well as a better awareness of what the future service offering of broadcasters is likely to be, as across their terrestrial, catch-up and other online services. This in turn informs a shared view on what is appropriate and sustainable in terms of content quotas, what flexibility can be sensibly introduced, for example. Similarly, it informs a view on the implementation of audio description or even what research is required around media consumption. Time and again, Labor has sought information about the release of this communications policy roadmap, yet it has not been forthcoming. It's no coincidence that in that time, the government's approach to media and communications reform has been piecemeal, lacking coherence and beset with delay and indecision. In 2016, the government proclaimed it would be enacting the most significant reforms to our media laws in a generation. In fact, so inadequate were these regulatory changes that only 1 year after their passage through the Parliament, the ACCC made a preliminary recommendation that there be a sweeping review of media regulatory frameworks, something I had called for in 2016, but which was dismissed by the government on the false basis that all the relevant facts are already known. What's more, the ministerial direction that serves to prevent the primary piece of legislation, that is the Broadcasting Services Act, from applying to or regulating the internet is due to sunset in October this year. Now, I will be keen to hear the government explain how it regards the status of that instrument in the context of the broader reform task it has left undone. The communications portfolio is feeling the weight of 6 years of stop-start policy making, of no coherent reform agenda, in everything from spectrum reform that has been underway for over 4 years with no end in sight, the stalled report of the Australian and Children's Screen Content Review, lack of implementation into recommendations on Australia's video game development industry, and leaving the recommendations of the Senate inquiry into the future of public interest journalism unaddressed. Just as citizens are frustrated by political short-termism, it is detrimental to the sector to endure such policy paralysis. But more important, and it brings me to my second point, it's a policy paralysis that is ultimately detrimental to consumers. Labor has long called for this roadmap to inform coherent and sustainable policy development, not for its own sake, but because of the values we hold and the benefits we want to realise for end users. The government's response has ranged from promising years ago that one would materialise, to mocking the request, to most recently committing to the release of one next month. Of course, it's quite ironic that the delivery of its roadmap is now scheduled to be released at the end of a parliamentary term rather than at the beginning. So what will that mean? To me, this is very much looking like a strategy in search of a value. Herein lies another lesson of the Turnbull innovation agenda. Governments need to be clear on what is important and what is less important and give itself one job. If you had one job, what would it be? Well, everything may be important. It's the values that help clarify what really matters in order to meet your objectives. Political values should be a judgment about what's good for the country. They help you discard the distractions and focus on the things that matter and the changes that would make a real difference to people's lives. The reason I touch on this point is because I want to emphasise that Labor's approach in the communications portfolio will be values driven. This is underpinned by a view that inequality is not just immoral, it's economically irresponsible. What excites me about the portfolio is that despite its modest size, it is so far-reaching and has so many touch points with the community. It has so much potential to include more Australians in society and the economy. It is within this context that I note digital exclusion continues to be a feature of inequality in the 21st century. According to the 2018 Australian Digital Inclusion Index undertaken by Telstra, RMIT and Roy Morgan, a substantial digital divide still exists in Australia. This is particularly true for those cohorts I mentioned earlier, Indigenous Australians, older Australians and Australians with a disability. Even in the land of the fair go, it's clear that inclusion and fairness are not self-executing. We have to work at it and we have to do better because there's so much to be gained by doing so. The way forward is to put the staff of the Australian Public Service back to work in conjunction with industry and community stakeholders to lay out a coherent and future-focused program of work, to conclude processes in accordance with best practice policy making, and to commence work on the broader reform agenda without delay. Now, speaking of values, the National Broadband Network is a project that is very important to the Labor Party and for us has always been a values proposition. It's not simply because we started it. After all, no telecommunications network is an end in itself. But because the original mission is the embodiment of our core values: access, opportunity, improving quality of life. Labor is a movement of and for the future. It's why we invest in human capital through education and childcare. It's why we back renewable energy. It's why we backed investment in world-class broadband infrastructure. We believe that investing in people and the productive capacity of our economy is the way to drive inclusive economic growth that's built from the bottom up. These investments are not just policy measures in isolation. They represent value judgments that become the broader narrative about the society we aspire to be. For me personally, the communications portfolio is an instrument to help create a smarter, more modern and more inclusive Australia. An Australia where connectivity and content enriches our quality of life, educates us, informs us and empowers us to fulfil our potential, whatever it may be. And this brings me to the future of the NBN. As a starting point, customer experience has to be a top priority. That's why Bill Shorten and I have announced Labor's plan to implement an NBN service guarantee. This will establish wholesale standards for fault rectification timeframes, installations and missed appointments, enforced through financial remedies that apply to NBN Co. A key design feature of our policy is that stronger penalties will apply when a small business is impacted. The goal here is not to punish telecommunications providers, but rather to incentivise more responsive service. In particular, a key focus for Labor will be to better safeguard these small businesses against unreasonable and excessive periods of NBN downtime. Less downtime and greater accountability is what we want to achieve. With respect to the longer term issues, one of the key policy challenges Labor has been grappling with is the future cash flows available to NBN Co. Cash flows have an important impact on public entities in the same way that budgets have an important impact on governments. If cash flow is healthy, you can invest more, be more flexible on prices, and provide services that the market would otherwise not deliver. However, if cash flow is not healthy, these objectives can become more difficult. The decisions in 2013 to change the technologies used on the NBN has had an unfortunate impact on cash flow. Relative to the original fibre plan, the multi-technology mix costs more to operate and requires higher capital expenditure. This is due to copper and HFC technology producing more faults, requiring more technicians and consuming more power. According to an ACMA analysis of industry data, the average household on these networks was reporting between 2 to 3.6 times more faults than those on fibre and making between 3 and 5 times more complaints. The government's own figures suggest the change in technologies has pushed up operating costs by significant amounts, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. In addition, the most recent NBN business plan also shows that in the year 2022, after the rollout is complete, taxpayers are still injecting $300 million per annum of capital expenditure into the copper and HFC networks. Yet in the same document, when we look at fibre to the premise or fibre to the curb, there was little to zero capital going into the existing brownfield footprints. These factors have pushed the NBN cost floor up. Now to revenue. It is reasonable to assume that if you offer a high quality and fast NBN, many people will be willing to pay for it. Again, this is where the multi-technology mix has its limitations. It generates less revenue as the copper network can't deliver the faster speeds that some are willing to pay for today and that more will be willing to pay for tomorrow. According to the ACCC, only 1 in 20 premises on fibre to the node are currently taking up a 100 megabits per service plan. In comparison on fibre, 1 in 7 are doing so, 3 times greater. A deep fibre access network would have also allowed NBN to play a complementary role in the rollout of 5G and create a new revenue stream by making fibre available to mobile operators deploying 5G cells. Regrettably, as Mike Quigley noted in his recent monthly essay, this opportunity has been diminished under the current model. It has turned 5G from being a potential revenue opportunity for NBN into a revenue threat. This has pushed the revenue ceiling down. Now, you probably see a picture emerging here about the impact of the multi-technology mix. The ongoing cost to run the NBN has gone up. The ongoing cost to remediate the NBN network has gone up. The revenue potential has come down. The result of this is the cash flows of NBN have been reduced. To put it simply, the Coalition's approach has done the following. It's cost more to build, it does not provide consumers with the same speed or reliability of the original plan, and leaves taxpayers at least several hundred million dollars a year worse off, potentially over half a billion per year worse off over the medium term. On top of this, the network requires future upgrades in the fixed line footprint that would not have been needed under the original plan. Now, if we had a less capable network that was significantly cheaper to build, you could sit here and have a genuine debate about the merits of one approach versus the other. But we don't. Our opponents promised to deliver the NBN for $29.5 billion. Then it became $41 billion, then $49 billion. Now it's $50.9 billion. In contrast, the original fibre rollout had a peak funding requirement of $45 billion, with a completion date by the end of 2021. Just about every key assumption underpinning this forecast has stood the test of time. To be fair, I'm sure that when Mr. Abbott and Mr. Turnbull announced their 2013 policy, they believed their approach would be cheaper. The problem is the NBN was far more complex than anyone outside of NBN management could have anticipated. There were so many integrated layers: engineering, construction, financial, legal, and the fact that it takes years to scale any new technology up, that it would have been near impossible for any opposition party to grasp what they were tinkering with. But once the tinkering began in 2013, the show fell apart pretty quickly. The irony of this situation is that the Liberals promised its Māori technology mix would be faster and cheaper. Yet we now have a business model that is in more need of cash flows, but has less capacity to generate it because of inferior technology and higher costs. Now, what does this mean moving forward? Whoever wins the next election will have a challenging task on their hands to reposition the NBN for the future. There is a careful balancing act to be struck. Now, if I could wind forward 6 years and describe the outcomes I'd want to see, it would be as follows. I'd want the NBN to be the network of choice for Australians. I'd want it to be delivering a good experience for consumers and businesses, with customer service getting better and more responsive over time. I'd want to know that Australian small businesses are benefiting from stronger service standards that reduce the downtime they experience. I'd want to see NBN services remaining affordable and delivering great value for money, with 5G competition helping to keep entry-level prices low. I would want to see more Australians experiencing the benefits of deep fibre connectivity, including greater speeds and reliability. I'd want to see regional Australians enjoying an improved quality of life as a result of opportunities enabled by the NBN. And lastly, I would want the NBN to be well on its way to becoming a brand that Australians trust and respect. That is, a world-class national broadband network delivering fast, reliable and affordable broadband, underpinned by good service and an authentic brand promise. It's pretty simple stuff when you boil it down, something we could truly be proud of. And it won't surprise you that I'm regularly asked what Labor's NBN policy is. I can start by telling you what it won't be. We won't be offering a quick fix, nor will we be making promises we can't keep. What I can say is that our NBN policy is close to being finalised, and I look forward to presenting our plans in the not-too-distant future. And what we will present, I believe, is a credible, responsible, multi-layered plan to improve the NBN. This plan will be about trying to connect the short term with the long term, and of course that place in the middle where one turns into the other. There was a vision articulated a decade ago that was the NBN, and a lot has happened since then. Some of that has been positive, and some of it not. Regardless of whether it is the network we wanted or not, if we have the privilege of being elected, a shortened Labor government will be committed to the NBN and its future. It's simply too important, both in terms of what it enables, but also what it says to the nation about itself, to not get the attention it deserves. Now, at a time when too many Australians feel disengaged from their democracy and distrustful of their representatives, Labor wants to restore trust and faith in our institutions. In a Western liberal democracy like Australia, the separation of powers is fundamental. The full and proper functioning and performance of the three distinct pillars of Parliament, the executive and the judiciary, is essential, as is the operation of the fourth estate, the media that holds the powerful to account. But all too often, this government has politicised what should be independent statutory appointments. And on many occasions, they've ignored the executive altogether, not even bothering to consult with the public service on policy proposals. It does little to engender trust when politicians bypass proper process only to gift large parcels of taxpayer funds directly to private entities for short-term initiatives. Having learnt nothing from the Great Barrier Reef Foundation debacle, the government recently threw $17 million at peak industry body Free TV to bolster Australia's soft power diplomacy in the Pacific without properly consulting the relevant departments, let alone Free TV or Pacific Nations. Despite the fact that two APS reviews into soft power are currently on foot, the government decided to blunder ahead with this ill-conceived and ham-fisted announcement. Further, it does little to engender trust when politicians, indeed when the Prime Minister, exhibits contempt for a statutory requirement to consult on the appointment of the ABC chairperson, a role predicated on independence and integrity, and merely informs the Leader of the Opposition on who the candidate is in the lead-up to a pre-arranged press conference. Having learned nothing from the political interference scandal at the ABC, the government awarded a $163,000 services contract to Korn Ferry, whose head of board services is a significant Liberal Party donor, to help recruit the new chair of the ABC. And just as people are sick of cynical short-termism, they despise the interests of big business being prioritised over the public interest. They're sick of the politicisation of their institutions and the endless jobs for chums. Labor has already announced that it will establish a National Integrity Commission to prevent, investigate and eliminate corruption inside the public sector and the federal government, and to restore the public's faith and trust in politics and the public service. And Bill Shorten has already announced that if he's able to set up the commission, the first reference will be Hello World. Rather than ministerial thought bubbles and backroom deals, Australians want well-crafted policy that is of real substance, value for money, and will stand the test of time. They expect the APS to be utilised to do what they're paid to do, which is serve the government, the parliament, and the Australian public with professionalism and provide advice to the government that is apolitical, frank, honest, timely, and based on the best available evidence. Labor has already committed to abolish the Liberals' arbitrary public service staffing cap, strengthening capacity and capability within the APS. It is my belief that the APS and the communications portfolio should be utilised to test and refine policy ideas and to progress coherent policy initiatives as part of a holistic program of work to transform our policy and regulatory frameworks that I discussed. Indeed, Martin Parkinson conceded in his response to the Auditor-General on the Innovation Statement that there was a need to ensure rigour and an evidence-based approach to policy design. The APS should not be ignored or bypassed, nor should they be misdirected on pointless bills and inquiries designed to undermine the institution of public broadcasting, which plays an important role in our democracy. Part of restoring trust in Parliament is supporting a healthy public interest media sector and protecting an institution that is actually trusted by Australian people, the ABC. Labor has been fighting against the government's cuts and attacks on the ABC to ensure it can continue to deliver on its charter for all Australians. One point that has been emphasised during the Senate inquiry into allegations of political interference in the ABC, which is now on foot, is to guard against political interference. Independent institutions like the ABC need stability. Labor has already announced that it will reverse the government's unfair cut of $83.7 million and guarantee stable funding for the ABC over the next budget cycle. Labor is currently considering the evidence adduced during the inquiry, which is due to report later this month. While questions about the conduct of the ABC board are a relevant area of consideration, what is plainly apparent is that this government has sought to interfere in the ABC in almost every conceivable way. More broadly, Labor acknowledges the importance of the Fourth Estate and respects the role of journalists and reporters within our system of democracy. The Fourth Estate in Australia has a strong track record of achievement in terms of exposing scandals and shining a light on corruption, which has precipitated a number of royal commissions and led to real change and improvement. Politicians might not always like what an individual journalist or news outlet asks or says, but to paraphrase Bob Carr in his book Run for Your Life, that's the price we pay for democracy. And while there's room for disagreement on matters of substance from time to time and lapses of judgment will occur, I believe it runs counter to the principles of our democratic system of government to criticise or mock a journalist simply for doing their job. However, that's precisely what we see the Premier of New South Wales and senior members of her government doing right now. Mocking a journalist who asked a perfectly reasonable question about a missing business plan, poking fun and naming their news outlet, branding them Operation Normal. The optics of a regional journalist who wanted to ask a question, being physically pushed away by security staff to his loud and professional protestations. The Treasurer laughing off an undeclared political donation. What Premier Gladys Berejiklian seems to fail to grasp is that with power comes accountability, and the scrutiny of politicians by journalists is the performance of an important civic function that goes to trust in our democratic system. Indeed, Scott Morrison too seems to want to deflect questions he doesn't want to answer as the Canberra bubble. In the end, however, these interactions do still serve to inform the electorate. They function to identify when a politician lacks the discipline to maintain their composure, emotional intelligence, or even simple humanity to answer the questions of a fellow worker in the field as part of a democratic exchange. Now, speaking of trust in institutions, I want to turn to Australia Post. Australia Post is an institution that's over 200 years old, and yet it continues to be relevant. According to Deloitte, 92% of Australians have visited a post office in the past 6 months. Now, that's quite a remarkable feat when you think about how much the world has changed and what the core business of Australia Post has been. Australia Post is among the most trusted brands in the country. 74% of Australians consider the institution to be a core part of our national identity and of significant heritage value. This is in no small part due to the 35,000 odd employees who do an incredible job day in, day out. They represent the company well and really are the heart and soul of the institution. I want to acknowledge Christine Holgate, the Australia Post CEO. As I said last year in the Pacific Connect Forum, Christine has instilled a sense of optimism about what might be possible, demonstrated a distinctive empathy for the role of Australia Post in the community. She's shown her determination to find new ways to grow the business by exploring opportunities that might otherwise have been left untouched. She is the kind of leader that every government business enterprise needs. Just recently, Australia Post secured an agreement with three of the four major banks to ensure Australia Post was fairly compensated for providing access to its retail network. And this is a very good result, particularly for regional communities where we have seen so many bank closures. When thinking about the future of Australia Post, there are several themes which come to mind. The first is the continuing need to embrace change. It's no secret that letter volumes are on the decline. Each year, businesses are sending fewer letters because the internet has enabled cheaper and more convenient options to reach customers. Before the GFC hit, there were 5.6 billion mail items going through the postal network. In 2017-18, this had dropped to 3.3 billion items. This year-on-year decline generally hovers between 8 and 11%, and it doesn't seem to be slowing down. Fortunately, over this same period, online platforms captured and enticed a new generation of online shoppers by offering greater convenience, value, and choice, and this led to a flourishing e-commerce boom. The challenge, of course, is whether the decline in letters outpaces the growth in parcels. For example, in the recent half-year results, parcels growth added $25 million to earnings, while the letters decline reduced earnings by $102 million. The reality for Australia Post is so long as letter volumes continue to decline, the business will never be able to stand still or become complacent. They will always have to adapt. They will always have to be innovative. They will always be faced with difficult choices. This means managing the decline of letters by finding efficiencies and productivity improvements, carefully managing pricing and constantly becoming better in utilising the capacity of the delivery staff and its network. It also means intelligently pursuing new opportunities to help cross-subsidise the unique social presence that Australia Post has in the community, particularly in regional Australia. My view is the role of government is not to resist change in the face of disruptive technology, because in the long run that's always counterproductive, and frankly speaking it does more harm than good. Rather, I think our role is to be engaged and, where appropriate, play our part to facilitate change in a manner that best serves the public interest. And this brings me to opportunities in Asia. One of the important opportunities is the growing middle class of the Asia-Pacific and Indo-Pacific, which has been talked about for some time. It's why Labor has developed a comprehensive and holistic policy to a deeper Asian engagement called Future Asia, a framework for more meaningful collaboration with Australia's Asian neighbours, both at an economic and cultural level. Towards the end of last year, I held an e-commerce roundtable. It was put to me by a Google executive that of the next 1 billion consumers to join the global middle class, 9 out of 10 of them will be in Asia. These consumers are increasingly shopping online. They're spending more and looking for higher quality goods associated with brands they trust. This is an arena where I really feel more Australian small to medium-sized businesses have the opportunity to play. I've heard some interesting examples where businesses conducted their first digital marketing experiments over social media into Asia to find their product take off beyond their wildest expectations. This prompted me to ask, how many other Australian SMBs are out there who have never taken that step but could stand to benefit? And who would they trust to provide them with the practical know-how to de-risk the process of experimentation and take that first step? As I noted earlier, Australia Post has a highly trusted brand, one of the most trusted in the country. And in a world where confidence, as I said, in institutions is waning, policymakers have scope to better leverage trust for public good. So often I've seen situations where government or business is trying to tackle a challenging problem and ultimately finds that trust is the only thing which cuts through. It reaches into corners that would otherwise be very difficult to reach. It can be a decisive factor in the moments that matter. I certainly hold the view that if there is a policy challenge that arises in the communications portfolio and we think trust is a critical part of the solution, we should be open-minded and creative in exploring ways to leverage what we have. Turning to the issue of leverage, I want to talk about leveraging platforms in the communications portfolio. The portfolio contains a number of key public institutions and assets, which in some cases have been built up, expanded and improved upon over successive generations of Australians. Key public assets that Australian taxpayers have invested in, own and value. Some of them are arguably more trusted and valued than others. Australia Post, the ABC, SBS, the NBN. Whatever your view, the reality is these are more than just institutions or assets. They are platforms. They are networks. They form part of broader ecosystems. As ever, it's what these platforms can do that matters. I'm interested in thinking about how we can leverage Australia's investment in these platforms in the 21st century. The ABC is more than just a broadcaster. The SBS is more than just a broadcaster. Community television is more than just a local broadcaster. Each of these platforms can contribute to the creative industries, including the screen production sector. What is striking is the effort this government has gone to wreck and undermine some of these platforms and destroy the value and potential they hold. Last year, we know, the Liberal Federal Council voted overwhelmingly to privatise the ABC, and it came off the back of coalition budget cuts to the tune of $500 million in specific election breach of a promise not to cut the ABC or SBS. Australians don't take kindly to being lied to about the institutions in which they have invested and in which they trust. Now more than ever, Australians need strong and vibrant commercial, community and public broadcasters operating across platforms to ensure diversity in our media voices. And of course, there are other major platforms in the portfolio, including the digital ones. The preliminary report of the ACCC's Digital Platform Inquiry is a commendable piece of work that in some way shows we've come full circle on the question of whether the media regulatory framework needs updating. Clearly, as the Convergence Review report published towards the end of the last Labor government recommended, an overhaul is necessary. Whoever wins the next election may well pick up where the Convergence Review left off, and the policy challenges will have been circumnavigated if not resolved. That said, I acknowledge the broad range of issues explored in the preliminary report, which, among other things, also demonstrates there are standard and novel competition issues and ideas in play that warrant further examination. Now, as a former telco lawyer, I spent 10 years arguing about the regulation, or not, depending on the client, of terminating access charges. I could grapple with a cost-plus model, the idea that you would recover your costs and retain a reasonable retail margin, but it would be for the regulator to test the reasonableness of how this figure was derived. Reflecting on that, as well as the browser wars of the late 1990s, it got me wondering, why did governments and best regulatory practice as a whole act sooner back then, but later about digital platforms? I think there's a sense now that governments left digital platforms to grow and innovate because they were so transformative and persuasive, and no one wanted to be the person to stifle innovation. It's easier perhaps to get your head around the implications of a choice between browsers or terminating charges, but less straightforward to grapple with a change of this scale. However, now there is a view that the digital platforms, once the disruptors, and now themselves so big, so vertically integrated, and, as some would argue, monopolistic in their behaviour, that they're stifling innovation in some respects. The clear sense I have is that it's up to governments to use the regulatory frameworks they have and adapt them when necessary. Clearly, there are some areas of competition law that possibly should have been utilised by now. We shall see as the ACCC progresses its work. But there's also been some maturity in the debate around traditional media versus digital platforms. I think we've moved on from the platforms are bad and old media are dummies line. Australia has been having reasonably nuanced debates about regulation and the online environment for a good 20 years. Now we're seeing much more sophisticated players from the content sector and the digital platforms. We've got the platforms demonstrating their support for news by trying to help them evolve and adapt to the new environment, and even giving some ground on its first click free policy. And we've got the content sector demonstrating they're innovators. They care about their content and the ecosystems they're within. Now, the staff of the ACCC have a great deal to work through as they prepare the final report. And Labor, meanwhile, is very focused on the future of public interest journalism. We are concerned about the health of the Fourth Estate, the large loss of jobs in journalism in recent years, and the ongoing consolidation of the news media. In Australia's highly concentrated media market, the democratising power of the digital platforms is potentially very useful, and it goes without saying that the innovation ushered in by digital platforms has enriched our lives. It's heartening to see a range of philanthropic developments materialise in support of journalism, including the Judith Nielsen Institute for Journalism and Ideas, and the announcement by John B. Fairfax of a new news investigative site. I applaud the efforts of the platforms and the content producers to partner, innovate and adapt to forge new pathways to support public interest journalism. That said, our content industries are such a vital underpinning of our cultural expression and national identity, as well as the health of our democracy, that Labor must be satisfied that our local content producers are getting a fair deal. So if content makers are innovative and digital platforms are pro-news, what is the missing piece? I suspect it is that we still don't have an agreed playing field, let alone a level one. The media is in transition, and to the extent there are some anti-competitive effects of the size and scale of the digital platform's success, that needs to be examined. And the regulators need to be involved too. They need to apply the regulations they have and adapt it when necessary. To that end, on the question of algorithm transparency, I do not see it as a case of knowing what the secret recipe is, but rather simply knowing whether it's harmful or not. If the digital platforms aren't the baddies and the news publishers aren't the dummies, nor then is government regulation the enemy of innovation. In conclusion, I sincerely appreciate your attendance here tonight. As was pointed out, the last time I addressed this auspicious gathering, it was as the member for Greenway, elected with a positive swing against the odds in 2013 on the back of some good luck. I hoped in that address to demonstrate that no one knocks back a bit of luck, but it took a lot of hard work to get that luck. Similarly, I've been very fortunate to have been entrusted by Bill Shorten with a portfolio that is my passion and was my professional life before public office. I'm even more fortunate to have maintained the mentoring and confidence of some of the smartest people I know, whom I've worked with or for over a decade as a lawyer and nearly a decade since moving to this new life. I'm very mindful that I'm putting myself forward as the alternative Minister for Communications in a Shorten Labor government. I hope my comments tonight have provided some food for thought on how I would approach the portfolio and its stakeholders, including that most important of stakeholders, the Australian citizen. Long-termism, a smart strategic focus, values-based. Make no mistake, ladies and gentlemen, the next election is going to be a close-run thing. As I've said before, addressing inequality and improving the lives of working people is Labor's defining mission. And a key part of that mission is to promote fairness and prosperity in a disrupted, broadband-enabled world. Growth and innovation is the goal, and it must be inclusive. To achieve that requires strong leadership and a vision for a better Australia. Thank you.
Many thanks, Michelle Rowland. So we've got no more than 15 minutes and a lot of people here, so keep your comments or questions very brief. Just briefly, as you said, it's a small department but a big area of responsibility. Very briefly, if you become the minister in a couple of months' time, what are the initial priorities? What's first off on the list?
So I think first off is probably the highest spending item, which is the NBN. And certainly I think I talked about some of the mistakes the previous government had made. I think one of them was to engage and to spend too long engaging in legacy busting. I think the Australian people recognise that we've had two terms of the NBN under Labor. We've had two terms under the Coalition. In fact, we've reached the point where it's actually been under the stewardship of the Coalition for longer than under Labor. I don't think the Australian people will have any truck for any legacy bashing or it continuing to be a political football. I think they want it fixed. They want to know there's a pathway for getting their services fixed and for getting value for money. So it will be dealing with the customer experience, but it will also be with that very difficult issue of the economics of the NBN.
Thank you. John?
No matter what the technology of the NBN is, Australians are currently and in the future facing a very big problem, and that is the scamming that is going on through the services. Anybody connected to a home phone, a VoIP service, which they have to do under the new regulation, no longer landlines from Telstra, is harassed. And your own ACMA is reporting at the moment that up to 50% of adult Australians every day are getting a scam phone call. The United States requires that the telcos have software in place to stop that as much as possible. Australia doesn't have that yet. Would Labor implement an early regulation requiring telcos to put in appropriate software to stop these harassing phone calls?
You're absolutely right on the issue of scams. I think all of us have experienced it where we've seen a number come up on our phones even, and the country recognised as anywhere from Lithuania to Estonia. But the reality is that people have been getting ripped off for a long time through a variety of scams. I think the level of phone scamming at the moment, not only coming from overseas is a very serious issue, and it's complex because it involves where numbers are originated around the world and so forth. But certainly people purporting to be from the NBN and scamming vulnerable people is absolutely unacceptable. Now, the ACMA has had a scam project in place for some time. It only just released its terms of reference yesterday. That is supposed to be doing some initial reporting by July and finishing by December. I think the sentiments you expressed, John, are that something needs to be done now. Something needs to be done urgently. We've been very much engaged with the sector on this, including major providers like Telstra. And as you say, there are mechanisms to be able to do this. The UK and some other countries, New Zealand, have looked at these. And I definitely think it's something that needs to be prioritised more than it is.
There's a question down there. You've got to be brief, Richard.
Shadow Minister, you mentioned the ABC at length. Could you disagree that there are no Conservative presenters on any of the major ABC television or radio programs? And as a result of that, there is a distinct left-green bias in ABC current affairs.
I know that that's something that a lot of people consider exists. Personally, I haven't seen that. In fact, when I get on the ABC, I'm often given, I think, sometimes a harder time than other people. But as I said, I think that goes with the territory. And I know that there is a view that the ABC doesn't go hard on people of certain persuasions, but goes harder on others. I think the important thing to stress here is it's an independent organisation. It's not supposed to be connected to government or be under any form of government directive. And I think that the ABC continues to represent the vast majority of Australians who trust its news. It's one of the...
No, hang on, Richard. Just conclude that. OK, we've got to move on. Conclude that.
The vast majority of people trust the ABC. I think that's borne out by the surveys that are made. And whilst I respect your opinion, I would just simply look at the stats and look at the evidence.
Now, we've got to be brief. There's a question here. Yeah.
So 5G presents a major threat to NBN, especially the profitability of NBN, given the current limitations that you mentioned.
Yes.
Just wondering if the Labor government will support NBN to take on that competition.
I think when you talk about supporting the NBN, I think by making it more competitive, it does require some really deep thinking about where the substitution threats are and where there are opportunities to partner and to leverage off 5G. I think it's true that in some areas 5G will be more of a substitute where the NBN is not satisfying demand. But in other cases, it will be complementary because we need to remember that this is a mobile network. It's not a fixed access network. It wasn't designed to carry the amount that amount of data. So in that sense, they'll always be complementary. But I certainly think that there are opportunities in future. And I think, you know, as I pointed out, you know, there should be scope for the NBN. 6 years from now, that's something I would like to see under whatever government is in there, actually able to leverage off 5G and 5G actually providing some competition to keep entry-level prices down.
Question here.
Shadow Minister, given that you get elected into government, you'll be inheriting what you find in the NBN. Would it be a pragmatic assumption to make that you would be dialing up fibre to the curb, given what you inherit?
We called for an expansion of fibre to the curb some years ago, and we've made no secret of the fact that where certain areas were not in design or construction phase, there should be an emphasis on taking fibre as deep as possible into the network. As Bill Shorten's made clear, you know, unfortunately we do have parts of Australia that have fibre to the node copper technology. We're not in the business of ripping those up. But what I think the public expects, and what I get from having gone around to some 50 or so forums with community groups, is they do expect a plan. They don't expect that there'll be a magic quick fix, and they do understand that it will take time. But as we've repeatedly said, a lot of these decisions needed to be made either now or in a couple of years previous. Now, it is a good thing that they took on board, NBN Co ended up taking on board Labor's calls for fibre to the curb to be expanded, but we will still have those areas, including HFC, which is a technology that it continues to be highly problematic in the NBN network. We will have to deal with all of these, and quite frankly, whatever government is in power after the next election will have to deal with all these things, because the economics are so dire as a result.
So are you expecting greater government expenditure here, or different management?
Look, I think there's going to be a different set of priorities. Certainly, issues about the management and expenditure are ones that I would leave, we would leave to be decisions in government, if for no other reason than, as I pointed out, coming from opposition and the information asymmetry you have, it's very unwise to start making such such decisions from opposition.
We're getting close to the end, got to be brief.
What do you think about this telcos outsourcing the train areas to overseas companies?
I think outsourcing, if you're talking about outsourcing customer service and outsourcing jobs, I think obviously these are decisions for individual telcos to make, and I note that Andy Penn said some time ago, we don't have enough trained staff in Australia, which was his justification for why they were looking overseas. But in terms of the customer-facing element, I think there is immense frustration by many consumers, not just of telco products, but of many other services, when they are put to a number of overseas call centres. Sometimes that triage function is actually counterproductive, and it makes people frustrated. It's something that I am aware that the telcos are very alive to as well, and that customer service is one of those non-price terms that really can be a product differentiator for them.
Final question about the ABC and SBS boards. As you know, this government, making the appointment of the ABC chair and appointments to the board, acted in accordance with the existing legislation that was brought down by the Rudd-Gillard government. So if you're not happy with that kind of procedure, do you propose to change that legislation that made the appointment of Mr. Milne and the recent appointment of Ms. Buttrose possible, or are you happy with the system and just would operate it differently?
Well, the point I would make, Jared, is that you can have the best processes in the world, but if a government is not willing to abide not only by the spirit of them, but by them in practice also, then that creates real tensions. I think the fact that Korn Ferry was engaged to do this recruitment process for the chairperson, we spent something like $160,000 of taxpayers' money. They came up with a list that was unsatisfactory to the government. The government could have at any stage in that process, and we know the minister suggested to Mr. Milne that he apply, why didn't anyone suggest to Ms. Buttrose or any other woman that they apply when there were no women on the shortlist? Why is it that instructions were not given to the recruiters that we want to prioritise people, perhaps women, being on that board or being considered as chairperson? So I guess I know that there are a lot of calls for reform of the process, but let's remember too that when it was set up, it really was set up to improve that transparency and accountability, and it has worked in the majority of situations. But when the minister goes off and appoints people who haven't been recommended, haven't been on the shortlist, then, again, I would go back to my point that you can have the best processes in the world, but if they're not adhered to, then you can't blame the process.
Many thanks.
Pleasure.
At any time, Michelle Rowland's a very busy politician, but particularly in the lead-up to an election, so we're particularly grateful tonight that she's given us her time to come along and give an important speech on Labor's policy in the area of communications, and a good insight if Labor gets the government within a couple of months, what all the priorities would be, and in addition, the early priorities. So we're very grateful for you to come in here tonight. We'll publish your paper in full. It'll be on Sky News, it'll be on podcast tomorrow. But for tonight, well done and thank you.
Thanks, Sher. Thank you. Thanks, Adam.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.